Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
February 18th, 2019, and as always, a lot to go over today. I want to start with a couple of specific follow-up stories to something that we recently talked about, and then get into a lot of different stuff today in regard to Venezuela, as I talked about in the title, the more so exposed fake humanitarian aid effort that we're seeing, as well as some really disturbing information about, guess what, another sexual deviant that's in the ruling class gets released early from prison while people are serving lifetimes for cannabis at some places in this country, as well as some contradictions in regard to what's going on in Yemen and much more. So please stick with us all the way to the end. And as always, I'll break these up for people that want to watch just the segments. But let's get into the quick follow-up stories for the day before we get into some of the larger topics. This that I've been continuing to follow up on because it's definitely very important to a lot of people in regard to the wall and how this is going to play out. And I think this whole story is being, whether that was the design from the beginning or not, being contorted into something that's going to be used to keep us divided and fighting until 2020. That's kind of what I see this playing out to. But a quick follow-up from Zero Hedge. Resolution to block border emergency likely to pass, forcing first ever Trump veto. Now, this for me is more important than just the fact that he might have to veto, but what happens if and when they potentially get supermajorities and he's not allowed to veto? If that's, and it is possible, and it seems more likely based on what people are saying here, but if that does happen, he does it anyway. That's just one more strike against the illusion of our democracy, showing you that they just don't care what Congress or the American people actually want. But this is an interesting story. So a handful of influential Senate Republicans actually have started expressing their reservations about President Trump's decision to call a national emergency to secure another $7 billion in funding for his promised border wall or, you know, barrier or fence. Kind of they're all just this amalgamation of terms now, is that one is not the same as the other, but that's how it's being sold now. Now, it's becoming increasingly clear that a congressional challenge to Trump's order will likely clear both the Democrat-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, provoking the president to issue what would be the first veto of his presidency. But this, understand, is assuming they don't get a supermajority, more than two-thirds from each side, and it will not be able to be vetoed, technically. Now, both Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth and Ohio Republican Representative Jim Jordan said on ABC's This Week that they expect a resolution in Congress to terminate Trump's order would have enough votes to pass both the House and the Senate by simple majorities, and that's the difference. He needs more, two-thirds or more, to be able to stop the veto. But clearly showing you that the majority supports the idea of not declaring this a national emergency. Now, the resolution will likely run into trouble if Trump issues the veto, which he will, because it's doubtful that the Democrats could muster enough votes in the Senate to override this, again, being two-thirds majority. But he will absolutely veto this, which, again, the idea of vetoing a challenge to the executive branch authority is kind of counterintuitive in its own right. It shows you how hard it is for anything to actually go against that power. Now, with this order, Trump will redirect, and this is important for people to understand where the money's coming from, with the national emergency order, will redirect $3.6 billion in military construction funding toward the border project, and will also take separate executive action, repurposing about $2.5 billion from the Department of Defense's drug interdiction program, which I found very interesting. We're talking about the wall in regard to stopping drugs, but we're taking $2.5 billion from the very idea of the program's meant to stop those drugs and using it to build the wall. Interesting there. And $600 million from the Treasury Department's asset forfeiture fund. Now, some clearly are saying, oh no, we're taking money from the military, which I don't think is a problem at all, personally. But it also shows you how easy it is to take these funds and use them when they want to. All the things we pretend we don't have money for in this country, well, yeah, we'll just shave off a quick $7 billion from all these other places, you know, the military, where we don't need all this extra money. But that's a separate point. Now, officials said the goal is to ultimately build roughly 234 miles of barriers along the border. Again, the ambiguous definition now of what this is, a wall, a fence, a see-through, steel, plat, or whatever the things they're saying. Now, the funding is on top of the roughly $1.4 billion earmarked to build 55 miles of barrier as part of the border security compromise passed last week. So how this goes forward, I personally, as I said before, I think this is treating a symptom of a problem, not actually addressing the problem, but that's what our politics are in this country. And now this is going to be dragged on. you can see the clear effort of one side being against this, not because they're against the policy, but because they're against Donald Trump, and the other side doing this because it's a campaign promise when it's really not actually addressing the real problems going on, when in fact the administration's current actions in South America are largely driving the problem. But we don't talk about this stuff. We only talk about the carefully cultivated left versus right paradigm, and you pick a side and you argue it. We ignore all the superfluous information. It's really not even superfluous, but the stuff that exists around the outside. Now, I took a lot of heat in my last show from a lot of different people for simply pointing out a fact in regard to this discussion, and I wanted to be very clear about this. Now, I said in the last show in regard to the wall and immigration that to get rid of the welfare programs that are driving people to want to come here illegally, it would be a big factor in actually addressing the problem. Now, here's something for people that may not, that again, fighting from within the two-party paradigm and not doing their research, 63% of non-citizen households access welfare programs. It's a simple fact. The information's widely out there to be seen. Now, people that may say, oh, well, that's just non-citizens. Well, point of fact, a non-citizen in the Census Bureau data is, or of non-citizen Census Bureau data, roughly half are in the country illegally. So we're talking about a massive portion of people that are here illegally as non-citizens and using and accessing welfare programs. Now, that's not even to take a side on the discussion. The reality is if we're actually wanting to fix the problem, we should actually be addressing what's causing it, not the symptoms of the problem, is what I'm talking about there. But for those that are angry about that topic, that's just a simple fact. And I very strongly support the idea of free movement. But the reality is this is the law that's currently there. We can't just have our Congress circumventing laws that they just don't like, just like Trump is doing on his side. This is the sad reality. We need to look at the facts, not our opinions, not our feelings about these topics. Now, moving on to the other story that I want to cover before we get to some of the bigger stuff today. Actually, this is really a big one for me, but it's something I just wanted to quickly go over because it's disgusting to me that this keeps happening. From Zero Hedge, Anthony Weiner goes free. Stiff sentence turns soft as ex-congressman gets early release. Clearly trying to, a little wordplay there with the title, as they always do with this person's name. But this is a disgusting example of somebody getting an extremely light sentence and then getting it even a smaller sentence and getting let off early. It's disgusting to me that it shows you this two-tier system in our country, especially when it just so happens to deal with sexual deviancy of the ruling class, usually in regarding children. And this is just disgusting. Well, again, there are literally people going to prison for their lifetimes for accidents, the things they should be held accountable for, but such as driving under the influence and hitting something and having to go to prison for, there's a case in Idaho right now where a kid, mind you, was out drinking and driving, and he should be held accountable for that and hit somebody and they died. Sad story. But he's now going to prison for the rest of his life. Now, do you think that someone who rapes children and is involved in the kind of things we're going to talk about today, whereas this is just sexual deviancy, should be let out this quick when someone that makes a mistake goes to prison for life, or someone that has a gram of weed in their pocket in certain states and goes to prison for years? Well, this man gets let out after months. It's disgusting to me. I'll get into that more in a second. Now, Weiner began serving what was supposed to be a 21-month prison sentence in November 2017 after pleading guilty to sexting with a 15-year-old North Carolina girl. He was scheduled to be released in August 2019, but managed to slash 3 months off his sentence for good behavior, moving his departure date from federal custody to May 14th. But understand, this is even more than just 3 months off, because he's currently being released and they're including that time in the time where he's, have to living in a halfway house. And yeah, but I'm sure it's different how these things work for people in the ruling class. Now, it says, to be sure, Weiner must spend a few more months under federal supervision before he's completely in the clear. Under the terms of his release, which is now, Weiner must now spend a few additional months in federal custody, either in a halfway house or a supervised pre-release program. But I'm sure that's a white-collar, high-end pre-release program, before he can lawfully re-enter society. Weiner served his time at the Federal Medical Center in Devens, Massachusetts, which is, the kind of place like they put Epstein, where he received treatment for his condition of being a registered sex offender. This is absolutely disgusting to me. He's getting even more than 3 months off because he's out now. This idea of letting people like this off for nothing is something that is a reoccurring situation in this country that I've talked about numerous times on the website, on this show, such as the person that was second in line to the presidency under George W. Bush, former House Speaker Dennis Hassert, was sentenced to only 15 months in a child molestation case where the judge literally called him in front of the courtroom a serial child molester. And this man gets only 15 months. Only 15 months. And then guess what? Oh, he gets let out early, you know, of being in prison for raping children. This is how this system works. We've talked about Jeffrey Epstein, working with, of course, Trump's labor secretary, Alexandra Acosta, you know, to avoid actual federal charges, went to only serve 13 months in a cushy prison where he was allowed to leave every day. We have to see an organized effort here, a pattern in developing right in front of us. Here's judge protects him, won't allow damning evidence in the case because they can't let these people that we work with, apparently the FBI too, letting these people slide because they can make deals and get out of it because of their position, because of their wealth. What about just the idea of the Silsbee trial where the woman was caught trafficking children from Haiti and Clinton got her off? What about Clinton herself? All these things, these people being charged with crimes that the average person would be in prison for the rest of their life and they get nothing. This is a very disturbing pattern that we're seeing develop. Silsbee currently works for a child alert system under a different name, mind you, under Laura Gaylor. But Laura Silsbee was caught trafficking children and was charged with human trafficking, went to the trial for it, and Clinton was the one that got her off. This is the classic story that we see in this country. And now we have Wiener getting out for basically nothing. And again, a convicted, charged, tried, in prison sex offender. It's just disgusting to see this play out. And it just shows you again the obvious two-tier system in this country. The ruling class has their own tier that's completely separate from the average person. Really needs to stand out to us today. But I just wanted to point that out before we got into everything else. But I want to start with the big story today that I wanted to cover. I thought was very interesting coming from anti-war because it has to do with everything they're currently arguing about in Congress and showing you the utter lies that politicians are being told or that they're saying themselves if they actually know that this is a lie. But there are congressmen and women that are saying that the U.S. is not even involved in Yemen. But guess what? A U.S. general just said right now the U.S. is in Yemen and we're supporting the Saudis. And this is something that has to be made obvious to everyone because the ridiculous nature of our political system today. They can get away with just absolute fabrications based on what the general mainstream media consensus is. But I like when I see stuff like this because the general's coming up and saying, yeah, you know what? We're still there right now and we're fighting in Yemen. Now, last week's House vote on ending the U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen saw repeated arguments that the U.S. was just simply not there, providing no direct support for the Saudi invasion, just kind of casually helping them with weapons that we didn't know were going to Al-Qaeda. Right? This is the story we're hearing. But now Major General David Hill clarified over the weekend that the U.S. Army is, in fact, still supporting Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Pretty simple. Now, while not going into a lot of detail on the matter, the general said the U.S. support is in particular focused on helping the Saudis target their airstrikes to, quote, minimize the risk of civilian casualties. Now, as the article points out, that's quite a risky admission that he just said, given the shocking number of civilians that have been consistently killed in Saudi airstrikes. The increasing amount, mind you. So if they're even trying, which I doubt they are, they're not doing very well because the Saudis are continually killing more and more civilians and children and elderly over and over and over. Higher rates, higher numbers that go up with every passing month. So the idea of them saying, yeah, we're just trying to minimize how many children they kill. Like it's okay for some children to be murdered during an illegal war. It's just, it's ridiculous to me. Now, those civilian deaths are a major part of why Congress, the ones that seemingly are trying to fight for this, want the U.S. out of the war. So it's very interesting to see this being one of the things that he openly admits to. Now, though the House voted to end U.S. involvement in the war, the Senate has to pass its own accompanying legislation, as you know, on the matter as well. Even then, President Trump has threatened to veto it, and he likely will. But it's unclear that Congress has enough support in general to override that veto. I don't think they would in this case. Thank you for the super chat. But again, this is also the bill that got secretly added with the anti-Semitism act, basically, or not the act, but the amendment seeking to basically combat anti-Semitism all around the world, making it a national security interest of the United States to combat anti-Semitism around the world. So that changes this for me on whether Trump might veto it or not, but we'll have to see how it plays out. Either way, all of this is getting absolutely ridiculous. The lies being told from our own congressmen by our mainstream media. It needs to be just abundantly clear that we're not getting the truth from any level of our government or our mainstream media in any way, shape, or form. Hopefully people can begin to see that. And here's for some more actual reality on the ground. Here's a tweet from Hussein al-Bukhaidi you just shared with me. A very sad reality. And it says, when almost 4 years of war and blockade on Yemen make Yemeni children have their skeletons outside their bodies, as you can see in the sad images there, it is a US-UK-backed war on one of the poorest countries in the region, due to previous U.S. and Western efforts in that country to rape them of their resources. Now, the result of Western government sales of weapons to Saudis and UAE coalition is what you're looking at. We will not forgive and we will not forget. It's very sad. I hope you support Hussein al-Bukhaidi on the ground as he continues to try to share with us what's really going on there. What's really happening on the ground that the media, one of the worst humanitarian crises in history, if not, obviously currently in our scenario in our world today, it is by far one of the worst things happening, if not the absolute worst. As again, the UN has called it the worst in human history. Now, ask yourself two questions. Why the U.S. is somehow okay being a part of this while pretending other people are doing bad things they want to, you know, protect these people from, and why the media continues to ignore what is at the very least, one of the worst things happening in the world today. You can't ignore such obvious examples of trying to cultivate your perception of the world. Now, moving on to some other foreign policy information about Syria and something we recently covered, this coming from Mint Press News. As mainstream journalists acknowledge Duma attacks were staged, as we've covered, the humanitarian Syria regime change network tries to save a sinking ship. And this is the effort we're seeing that is just, it's just so obvious of people coming out of the woodwork to try to protect this fragile lie that they've built up around Syria, the, you know, gas attacks in Syria, all stemming from the white helmets. And now despite some of their own standing up and saying, yeah, we have to admit this has been completely staged, they're now coming out of everywhere to try to fight for the fact that these people are only trying to attack small little intricacies of this story, and it's not really about the bigger idea. They're just trying to ignore a lie. And as always, trying to cultivate your perception of what's really going on here. Now, this began with James Harkin, as the article points out, a journalist who has written for The Guardian, Harper's, for Financial Times, and is currently the director of the Center for Investigative Journalism, as well as a BBC producer, which we've covered, named Riyam Dalati. Now, these people have been calling things out for quite a while, but this story really began to develop when James Harkin started pointing this stuff out and Riyam Dalati came on board once again for a second time and started pointing out all the lies and how he feels he has proof that this was completely staged. He said, quote, I'm sick and tired of activists and rebels using the corpses of dead children to stage emotive scenes for Western consumption. And points out the very widely spread last hug photo where they drug people from two different rooms and positioned them just right for Western propaganda purposes. Now, Dalati had notably been a member of the production team of the notorious September 2013 BBC Panorama documentary, quote, Saving Syria's Children, notorious propaganda, a report that was forensically investigated by independent researcher Robert Stewart, who concluded that, quote, sequences filmed by BBC personnel and others at the Atreb Hospital in Aleppo on 26th of August 2013, purporting to show the aftermath of an incendiary bomb attack on a nearby school, are largely, if not entirely, staged. This is from Robert Stewart. Now, as I recently covered, Dalati has once more broken with the ranks of mainstream media by admitting that the White Helmets chemical attack, the scenes in Duma, were without a doubt, he said, completely staged. Now, instead of acknowledging the truth, we have journalists and, you know, so-called experts who have linked their professional reputations to the credibility of groups like the US, UK, incubated and financed White Helmets, are now going on the absolute offensive in an effort to trivialize the recent revelations regarding these events. For example, Tobias Schneider, A research fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute, the GPPI, has accused people like Harkin and Dilati of, quote, squabbling over the intricacies of the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma, later calling these independent investigators and statements madness. Madness, these people would dare point out that this entire event was staged. Oh, that's just one aspect of a larger story. Like, it won't play a factor to realize that the mainstream media was intricately involved with staging an event. But yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with all these other events we want to point at. It's ridiculous, the aggressive effort for these people to cover for an obvious lie being exposed. Now, guess what? Tobias Schneider, working for the Global Public Policy Institute, the GPPI, just so happens to have released just today an entire expose of all of the chemical events that the Assad family was responsible for. The timing of this truly cannot be ignored. So we have mainstream media coming out all over the place saying, yeah, this entire event was staged. Oh, quick, let's rush out about our nowhere to hide the logic of chemical weapons use in Syria report and spread this information about all these events that we got. Literally, here's the funny part. We're talking about stories that are proved to be faked by the White Helmets, while their leading source in this kind of information is, guess what? The White Helmets. Funny how that works out. But all of these are totally true. And you over there looking into the intricacies of this one case are just obfuscating the reality. No, the reality that you guys are willing to stage events to achieve an agenda, that is a reality that cannot be overlooked. It's just humorous to me, the timing and the effort. And of course, this article, you know, from Tobias Schneider, the guy who was just attacking them, this study was spread by all the usual suspects, all the mainstream media jumping right to it and saying, oh, look, Syria used chemical weapons more than 300 times, according to this report. Report says. Over and over. But what I found the most interesting is that they never once dared to report on their own people saying, oh, this was all staged. This is all faked. But now the moment they have something else that can counteract that, oh, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Again, for those that are dutifully paying attention, this is nothing new. These media outlets are simply there to propagandize you. And they don't care about spreading anything that counteracts their narrative, showing you yet again, they have no interest in actually informing people. Unless it aligns with their agenda. So now we have the very group, the person at Tobias Schneider at the Global Public Policy Institute coming out with his own information right after they're all exposing the lies about all of these cases of chemical attacks. So the statistics, according to these information, were announced by the Global Public Policy Institute just yesterday and constitute, as they claim, the most comprehensive, up-to-date findings on the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Of course, the study was first published by the Washington Post and could be cited as part of a possible international war crimes case against the Syrian government. The timing is just staggering to me. Now, the Berlin-based policy group said that it had, quote, credibly substantiated 336 uses of chemical weapons ranging from nerve agents to dangerous chlorine bombs. Now, of course, the report's researchers said that they had derived their findings from witness statements and post-attack analysis. But leave it at that, right? We're supposed to guess that all these people are, you know, not people that they're aligned themselves with the aggressive regime change policy in Syria. It says, quote, the Assad regime did not merely get away with its use of these banned weapons, but it succeeded in using them for strategic ends, it says. There's nothing strategic about the things they try to say that happened, most of them now being debunked. Because there's no strategic purpose for using chemical weapons to ineffectively murder a lot of random people. This is the stupid narrative they try to sell to people. You have a government that is on the verge of taking back its country. You have the Western powers on the run. What could you possibly do that would give them an excuse to stay in Syria? Oh yes, let's use the one thing they said we're not allowed to do. That's very strategic, but this is what they want you to think. That he's somehow using chemical weapons strategically to kill people at the right times when he's empowering himself. It makes absolutely no militaristic sense, but they know this. They just don't think you know this. Now, in the aftermath of 2013, it says the nerve agent attack on the outskirts of Damascus, you know, the one that it's been proven by the UN to be carried out by the rebels, but they don't talk about that. More than 72 tons of chemical weapons were destroyed. Again, showing you that they destroyed all the weapons back at this point that Syria had access to. But then they say, but the attacks didn't stop. So it's funny how your own institutions went in there to take them all away, destroyed them all, but the attacks kept going on, but then it was still somehow Assad. And they go on to say there has been no recorded use of chlorine weapons in Syria since the last U.S. missile strike on 14th of April. You know, the missile strike that the United States carried out after the staged event in Douma that they know now was completely staged because their own people are admitting to. And we also have people like the Independent going there and talking about the reality there. We have OAN being there. We have Vanessa Bealey and Eva Bartlett, all these people on the ground proving that this was a fake event. And now you have the BBC producer and other people involved saying that it was completely staged, but they're still willing to sit here and tell you about the U.S. missile strike the U.S. responded to this fake event with. Staggering to me that they just want you not to be able to think for yourself. And of course, the chlorine that the OPCW themselves has said was not the case, but they're still saying it there. It just goes to show you that this perfectly timed GPPI report is meant to be used to counteract the reality that's being exposed by some of their own. Pretty damn simple to me. Now, to go on to some other foreign policy news and countering the oligarchs' half-hearted, played-out propaganda, as always, in regard to Venezuela, a story that's continuing to develop, this actually coming straight from NPR, which I found to be amazing. It literally says, the U.S. effort to distribute tons of food and medicine to needy Venezuelans is also designed to foment regime change, which is why many humanitarian groups want nothing to do with it. Damn, that's pretty straight up and right in your face coming from other mainstream media. Pretty interesting. I found that to be pretty. Now, again, doesn't mean just because it comes from mainstream media doesn't mean we should trust it or give it any more merit. But it just shows you that there are plenty of people who are recognizing that the U.S. entire effort of humanitarian aid is a ploy in order to carry out regime change that everyone is acknowledging, except the mainstream media that dutifully does what the government wants and the Western media that's just simply surrounding this in absolute lies. Except for certain people that are sidestepping it, which I found very interesting, showing you that it's not all-encompassing. We've also talked about the United Nations, the Red Cross, all these people coming out and saying this is a military, political effort that has nothing to do with humanitarian aid. We also just talked about 933 tons of humanitarian aid coming in from other countries, that the allies that they pretend is not happening. Oh, this humanitarian blockade from Maduro, he's evil dictator, while he's getting humanitarian aid from all kinds of other people that don't have a military political agenda. Funny how that works. But for the next story that's completely related, as I find incredibly interesting, as they're pretending that no humanitarian aid is getting in, even though it is all over the place, Trump sends U.S. military aircraft to deliver aid to Venezuelan border. I wonder what's going on there. I wonder who could possibly guess what this military aircraft delivering aid to Venezuela is actually doing. It's just, you know, they really need to get a new playbook, I think, in my opinion, but it's good that we can see through it. So the Trump administration has announced on Friday, along with, of course, a whole new round of sanctions against members of the Venezuelan government, you know, the legitimate Venezuelan government, that they are dispatching U.S. military aircraft carrying aid to Venezuelan border. Now, the aid can't get into Venezuela directly, as it's being sent to opposition leader Juan Guaido, and with an eye specifically toward endorsing him as the new ruler of Venezuela. Ruler, dictator, being appropriate because he was not elected and nobody voted for him. They just simply, he deemed himself president, and the U.S. that led it and created and stoked this entire thing from the beginning said, yes, we support you because we made this whole thing happen. As we know from numerous accounts of them being involved long before this ever came to pass. Now, instead, the aid will be sent to Cucuta on the Colombian side of the border, which is what they're doing, where they're building up all of their covert weapon shipments under the guise of humanitarian aid and fighting to get it in there because Maduro won't let any aid through except he is from everywhere else. But they won't tell you that. Now, the administration has repeatedly said that military intervention remains on the table in imposing regime change in Venezuela because they want you to know that we're totally willing to invade this country illegally like they will have in so many other places. Now, there's no timeline for that, though it's very clear that some Trump aides are pushing for action to ensure Guaido ultimately takes power because, you know, of their desire to establish an embassy in Jerusalem, from their ideas of privatizing the oil, from their ideas of basically giving U.S. multinational corporations access to everything in Venezuela. Yeah, this guy really seems to be a man of the people. And it's clear why they want him in power. And it's clear why most people in Maduro don't, because they're doing what's not in the best interest of Venezuelans. Now, while the U.S. struggles with this failing coup, and that's definitely what it is, it takes on an overtly hypocritical stance in Haiti, which is something we recently covered, but something that, again, is getting zero coverage from mainstream media because they're fighting a U.S. puppet government there. the dictator the U.S. put in place that has no concern for what the well-being of Haitian people. But because it's a U.S. puppet, you can see the overtly hypocritical stance of the U.S. in regard to Haiti versus Venezuela. It's pretty spot on. All U.S. citizens ordered out of Haiti amidst mass unrest and chaos. Of course, showing you that the U.S. is well aware of what's going on there, but they're not taking any action in regard to, you know, helping the people or standing with the government because it's a U.S. puppet government that's there. Doing what's best for American interests, not for Haitian interests. And Haiti is a place that has been manipulated since well before even when Clinton was Secretary of State, well before that. But we know that the Obama administration had some really, really, really nefarious things going on in Haiti. And that's a reason that people are not having this, knowing that Moïse is a U.S. puppet. Now, Haiti continues to be gripped by civil unrest and mass protests, demanding that President Moïse step down over multiple charges of corruption and rampant inflation under his watch. Funny how these are the very same things they're saying about Venezuela. Yet, unlike similar unrest happening hundreds of miles due south in Venezuela, Washington has stood in support of President Moïse. Starting Thursday, the U.S. State Department urged all American citizens out of the country and issued a no-travel advisory due to crime and civil unrest, again, showing you that they're well aware of the problem. Of course, National Security Advisor John Bolton followed with a statement on Saturday for all sides in Haiti to, quote, respect and protect their democracy. A bit ironic considering he spent the rest of the day tweeting regime change-related messages targeting Venezuela's Maduro. He revealed in the tweet that he met with Haitian Foreign Minister on Friday, quote, to express the United States' enduring support for and friendship with Haiti. But not with Haiti, of course, not with the people of Haiti, but with their puppet dictator that they put in place. See how he embodies Haiti when they're talking about Haiti, but Maduro embodies the illegitimate government, right? And we're talking about, when they talk about supporting Venezuela, they're talking about the people of Venezuela, but when they really mean Guaido. See how they use this to their benefit when they want to. The Haitian people are by and large revolting right now aggressively against the U.S. puppet, but they're only siding with him and his administration. They don't care about the people of Haiti, but they pretend to care about the people of Venezuela while they're trying to de-seat the illegitimate government. See, this is how this works. Now, he further urged Bolton, quote, all of Haiti's political actors to respect and protect their democracy, engage in dialogue and put an end to this political violence, right? Because they support the person they're trying to overthrow. Everybody, it would seem. But they want to protect that democracy. You know, the democracy that the United States government went in and usurped and put in a dictator all these time back. You know, democracy. It's only democracy when the U.S. is in its position of power. Now, mass protests paralyzed the Port-au-Prince region in Haiti starting over just a little over a week ago, and are in some aspects actually related specifically to the Venezuelan crisis. As one article pointed out, at work is a messy cocktail of political forces opposed to the Moïse's presidency. This is fueled in part by a judicial report issued in January that outlined massive embezzlement of Venezuela's discounted oil Petrocaribe program in Haiti, showing you that the Moïse government was abusing the goodwill of Venezuela and basically embezzling all this money for himself and for his group. They're the very same things they pretend to say is happening in Venezuela. Now, Washington has for weeks been putting immense pressure on Haiti to break its ties with Maduro in Venezuela in recognition of the, you know, undemocratically self-appointed interim president Juan Guaido. Now, these U.S. pressures worked, and the Haitian government caved early this month, adding fire to the rage of Haitians in the streets, many of which are already angered over the impact that Washington's oil sanctions on nearby Venezuela are having directly on Haiti. Funny how people actually recognize, look at U.S.'s aggressive foreign policy actions are even hurting the Haitian people. Even stories in the Dominican Republic. This is having effects on a lot of different groups. And this has a lot to do with the Petrocaribe program that Venezuela created. And this is what we have to understand. This is a beneficial program created by the Maduro government in order, or rather just by Venezuela, in order to benefit people in Latin America with the oil wealth of the country. Now, as according to Haiti analysis, for more than a decade, Venezuela has aided the governments of Haiti and the Dominican Republic through a preferential system known as Petrocaribe, which provided subsidized crude oil prices to meet the country's critical energy demands. You know, likely stepping in and helping where the Western powers are making it more difficult for them. It goes on to say the Petrocaribe oil agreement allowed for governments to pay only 60% of the oil shipments they purchased from Venezuela. The remaining 40% could be financed over 25 years as 1% interest as long as oil prices stayed above $40 per barrel. This allowed for tremendous saving and money that, according to the agreement, was supposed to be used for socially beneficial purposes, meaning that the money they saved were supposed to be put back into their countries to help the people. But we now can see Moise didn't do that at all and took the money for himself, which is what a lot of Haitians are very upset about and the thing that the U.S. is completely supporting because he's a U.S. puppet. It goes on to say further that countries such as Nicaragua, Jamaica, Cuba, and many islands in the Eastern Caribbean have successfully utilized the Petrocaribe funds from Venezuela and other Venezuelan support mechanisms, investing in vital infrastructure, education, healthcare, and have used the funding to avoid austerity deals with the IMF and other international financial institutions. Go figure. Ask yourself why they don't want to be indebted to these massive financial institutions run by the Western powers. It says corrupt politicians in Spain, whose regimes are closely aligned with Washington, have by contrast become well known for robbing many of the funds meant for the social needs of their population. Think about what they're saying here. That all the corrupt people that are allied with Washington are basically trying to take advantage of this program and use the funds to help their elite ruling class. While a lot of the Latin American nations are trying to use this to benefit the people that are struggling due to the U.S. thumb on top of all of them. And now all of this is falling away because of U.S. sanctions. So all these people that were using this to their benefit legally, legitimately, are now struggling. And all these countries are now beginning to get very unhappy with U.S. foreign policy. So Port-au-Prince was so easily succumbing to Washington's efforts against Maduro was apparently the last straw for many in Haiti in a politically complex scandal, which has grown for years as a result of the Petrocaribe deal, which began in earnest when it was revealed in 2017 that almost $4 billion in funds earmarked for social development just went missing in Haiti. Now, widely assumed to be the result of corrupt officials still within the Moise government skimming on a massive scale. Now, we have to recognize that all of these countries, and this is what we're talking about in their regard to U.S. sanctions affecting these people, and more than just in Venezuela. They are literally stealing from an entire network of people that were profiting and mostly going toward the civilian population because of the generosity of Venezuela. Now, again, that doesn't mean that everything they do is good, hardly. But in this case, it's very clear to see that their deal was helping all of these Latin American countries and giving them social welfare programs. And now the U.S. has stolen that from them. And now the U.S. is just aggressively supporting Moise because he's willing to do what they want and likely split the stolen money with people, I would argue. But that's just my opinion. But hopefully this shows you the absurd hypocrisy of the mainstream media and the government in regard to what's going on in Haiti, which is almost entirely led civilian uprising against the Moise government. And then when you have millions of people supporting Maduro in Venezuela, and all they're showing you is people like Guaido, and how CBS will show you a fake protest that actually takes place in Argentina and say, oh, look at these people fighting for their, you know, against the Maduro government in a different country. It's all propaganda, and all they want you to think is what they're doing is good and what anybody else does is bad. Because U.S. good guy, all the rest bad guy. That's what they want. As long as you go on board with that, you'll be okay in regard to the establishment narrative and mainstream media. But hopefully you're beginning to wake up to how aggressive the lies are in regard to all of this stuff. And of course, to end today, I want to point out that the establishment order is only increasing its efforts to just wipe away and delete those who actually choose to expose the obvious lies being used to manufacture consent for regime change wars and just profiteering. Sadly, someone has been doing some amazing work. This tweet from Rania of In The Now, it says Facebook has suspended all of In The Now's tweets, In The Now's Facebook pages, apparently in coordination with CNN. On the grounds that In The Now doesn't disclose who funds it, which is Repli. This is an outrageous standard that's not applied to outlets like NPR or AJ+, which, understand, these are groups that are government connected, but I guess it only matters which government. And that's the absurd nature of this. And this doesn't take into account how legitimate her coverage is or how factually correct it is. No, even though we have mainstream media getting caught every 30 seconds with some fake news or a manipulated story or a one-sided report, these people are doing an excellent job and they get shut down just because they're saying, oh, you're connected with this group, that group, bad guy. So you're bad guy. This is the juvenile childish mentality of people that are stuck in this paradigm. And she goes on to make some excellent points in this, which is a whole long thread that I recommend you read for herself. She says, CNN says it was alerted to In the Now by the German Marshall Fund, which receives funding from, guess who, the U.S. government. So here you have a U.S. government-funded outfit promoting CNN to help get us kicked off Facebook. You can't, the hypocrisy makes my teeth hurt. They don't care, though. It's not about left and right in this. This is about anti-establishment, anti-war versus establishment. And she goes on to say after that, this is a case where the U.S. government has found a legal loophole to suppress speech. In this case, speech that is critical of destructive U.S. government policies around the world. Even if you hate what I say in my videos, you should be outraged by this speech suppression. Hopefully, anybody that can see what this is outraged. As I am. And In the Now has done some excellent work. You know, whether anybody agrees with everything they do, they have a right to say what their opinion is based on what's going on. And I can promise you that their record of accurate reporting is 10 times better than any of the mainstream outlets you could point to today. And all they're doing is using government-funded outlets to shut down other groups they claim are funded by a government. It's just astounding to me. But the point is they are cracking down on anyone they can they think is large enough to actually affect the opinion. So that's why it's important for you today out there to fund your independent media, get out there and support anybody you feel is truly progressing the truth. Even if they, look, at the end of the day, there are people that get things wrong in the independent media too. But if people have, if they're ultimately their agenda is to fight for what they believe is right, that's what really matters. It doesn't mean they always have the right intentions, but if you're fighting for what you believe is correct, even if you're wrong sometimes, you're still fighting for what's right. And that's what's so important today is people get lost in what they're supposed to think. The left-right paradigm. What your side's supposed to be fighting for. And sometimes counteract what you feel morally is right or wrong. So today it's important that you stand back and disconnect yourself from the establishment narrative. From the mainstream media propaganda machine. From the left-right paradigm. And begin just asking yourself, what is right? What is wrong? And hopefully people like us can be here to guide you through that. So thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate you all. If you'd like to support this channel, you can do so in many of the links in the show notes below. Buy one of our Question Everything t-shirts. The links are in the show notes, as well as any number of other ways you'd like to support us. Super chats and all that. Thank you, Eagle Eyes, for the super chat. I love you guys, truly. I'm humbled every day by the support that we get from you. And yeah, he says, don't ever give up, T-Lab. Don't worry. I won't. Thank you, Sammy. I will not. No matter what happens, understand, no matter if they delete us from here or do anything else, we're going to keep doing this because it's important to fight for it. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.